Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Well, take it from me. Better grab your shades. If he looks at you, well, try not to look so afraid. Just do the best that you can, but don't you think that he won't know. Creosote's dripping from the highline poles. Fast as you can count them, 12 in a row. Blessed accommodations for the daily observations of a crow.
When a crow looks down from a telephone wire or a tree branch, what does it see? According to scientists, if it's looking at you, it will remember your face. And we'll be able to pick you out of a crowd at a later date. Hi, I'm Rick Ryer, and I'm in for Glenn Moberg today on Route 51. And today we're going to look at the connection between wildlife science and wildlife art. As we preview this year's Birds and Art exhibit at WASA's Lee Aukey Woodson Art Museum, our guests today are Kathy Kelsey Foley, the museum's executive director, Karen Bednarczyk, the master wildlife artist for this year's exhibit. Bednarczyk's work often focuses on ravens and crows, and she has been inspired by their almost human-like intelligence. For the perspective of science, we turn to Marge Gibson, executive director of the Raptor Education Group. Gibson treats thousands of injured eagles, raptors, waterbirds, songbirds, and blackbirds every year at her Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Anago. And as always, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can certainly put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and we'll read it live on the air. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kathy and Karen and Marge.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Happy to be here.
Kathy Kelsey Foley, it's now the 41st year of Birds and Art. That's incredible.
It is, Rick. It is extraordinary to think that an exhibition has, well, we like to say wings that have kept it aloft. And I think it's a tribute to the artist, absolutely. And I think also the staff, the community, the response worldwide, not just our local community, but the fact that the exhibition is continually growing and changing and morphing. When you take three words and you challenge, really, artists from all over the world to interpret those words, the results are exciting and ever-changing.
Well, in the catalog for this year's Birds and Art exhibit, you write in the foreword, exercise your power as a critic. What do you mean by that?
Well, the credit really goes to the New York Times film critic A.O. Scott, who inspired me to take that tact. It's something that art historians, museum curators, we always encourage people to look and talk about what they like and what they don't like. So being discerning requires that ability to judge, not just to say why, what, but why. So to be a critic, to be a thoughtful critic, I like X because I don't care for Y. And why you don't, that's what makes us more thoughtful. That's what hones our looking skills. And at the end of the day, museum exhibitions, art museum exhibitions, are visual arts experiences. We have to be able to look and communicate what we see.
I like the fact that you're talking about this right now and that you wrote this in the catalog, because when people go, at least this is my experience, you go to a museum, especially when there's a lot of people around, you're almost afraid to criticize or to say, well, I don't like this out loud.
Oh, my gosh. That's so important. And I'll tell
you,
so there are many of us who play this game, if you will. You know, when Jane Weinke, our curator of collections, and I are in New York, something that we love to do with some art dealer friends is visit the Metropolitan on Friday evenings when the Met is open late. And we'll pick different galleries and we will challenge one another to identify which work we'd like to take home. Now, understand that's not literal. It's a game. But then we have to explain to the group why we want X or Y. Or it's what helps you to be discriminating and discerning.
Karen Bednarczyk, your art has been featured a lot over the years at this particular exhibit. Mm-hmm. How does it feel this year to be the Master Wildlife Artist?
Incredible. It's been an amazing experience to work with the Woodson over the past few months, putting this together. And it's truly an honor. You know, one of the things that I've reflected on is that as artists, we're pretty solitary in what we do. We tend to work alone. We do get some feedback, you know, what we're talking about with criticism here. You know, sometimes we'll get intermittent feedback, but to be recognized and honored in this more substantial way that represents something long-lasting and in perpetuity it's just a real honor and very humbling.
Now, you're Canadian.
I am.
And you make your home in Michigan.
I do.
Where you're an associate professor of art at Western Michigan.
That is University. Correct, yes.
And you work in two-dimensional art and sculptures, and you do video and bookmaking. How do you transition between the different mediums, and what influences that decision for a piece that you do?
Well, I tend to think through material. So I may come up with an idea and a particular material will present itself and seem logical. I mean, that happened with the large-scale sculpture work that I created. One of those pieces is actually at the Woodson Art Museum for the exhibition. And I had been doing a lot of driving in Michigan and saw this material laying on the side of the road, scraps of tires that had blown out from semis. And when a semi tire blows, it creates a big mess of tire. I mean, many of us have had that experience mm-hmm. where we're driving and right. we, you know, are dodging to avoid hitting a tire. And I really just started thinking about the material as being interesting. And that was what really influenced and brought on the sculpture. Because I started to imagine claws sticking up in the air, which kind of led to me creating this large-scale bird. But, you know, I jump back and forth from two-dimensional to three-dimensional, or like I like to say, you know, from the floor to the wall and, you know, back again. And for me, it challenges my brain in a different way, because thinking about two-dimensional work requires a very different set of brain and eye activities than working in the round three-dimensionally. So for me, it's as much as anything, it's a way to keep exercising my brain artistically. So,
well, a lot of your pieces do feature crows and ravens, and they're not exactly the most colorful
no.
birds. You know, what attracts you to those two birds in the corvid family that they're in?
Well, you know, it started again with the sculpture, but I started to do research on crows and ravens at a certain point, and I was absolutely astounded by their intelligence, by their abilities that really rival the primates. Their brain capacity is not short of tool use, tool making, sequential thinking. It was their intelligence that really iced it for me. And I really saw in crows and ravens a deep connectedness to humans. I mean, certainly if you go far enough back, you know, reading Darwin and the evolutionary chain, you know, we're going to be connected to them. But it was really about their behavior, the gregariousness, the annoyance, the surprise. You know, they just have a lot of qualities that humans have. And so I recognized myself to some degree in crows and ravens. And as an artist, I think we always identify something of ourselves in what we do. And so I think that was there strongly.
That's fascinating. You know, a lot of people, when they see a crow, oh, it's just a crow. Just get out of here, bird, you know, that type of thing. But You know, I'm glad you brought up the actual word intelligence when it comes to crows and ravens and this whole family of birds. I want to read a real brief paragraph from Audubon magazine that was published in March and April of this year. It says, members of the crow family, known as the corvids, are among the smartest birds in the world. Some are capable of using tools, as we talked about already, playing tricks, teaching each other new things, and holding funerals.
Yeah.
And yet there's still much we don't know about these fascinating, sometimes confounding creatures. What's going on inside the mind of a corvid? And I'm going to leave that question to you, March. What's going on in their minds, right?
Well, I think we would be very shocked and surprised. I'm not sure I want to really delve into that. It's too active for me. My work has, over the last 50 years, has really allowed me a unique and special ability to spend quality time with a lot of species. And crows and ravens, are, of course, and jays are among those. Corvids are always interesting, fascinating, actually, and very different from each other. I mean, they're individuals, absolutely. And, you know, admitting two crows, you don't have the same creature at all. They're two different. They're absolutely as different as we are. And they're just fascinating, absolutely fascinating. The intelligence is almost frightening sometimes when you're trying to get them to cooperate with you. They often outsmart us.
And I've been reading about some studies that have been done with these particular birds when it comes to facial recognition. That is incredible. Are either one of you can explain what those experiments have been and what they may mean as we study them?
Well, there's they have done some really interesting experiments with using masks and using partial masks and exposing just, you know, a part of a person's face, for instance, the nose or an ear. And of interest, they recognize almost any part of a person's face, and they recognize them for their lifetime. So it really is fascinating. It's not just recognizing, you know, John Smith because he's been a kind person or a not kind person. They recognize them, even parts of their faces, which has been very interesting for our Homeland Security, actually, to start perhaps using them to pick out people of interest.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
It is, as you mentioned before, kind of scary.
Oh, yeah.
Now, believe it or not, there are some folks that don't know exactly what the Raptor Education Group does and your role with that. For those that are listening today that aren't familiar with it, tell us a little bit about what you're doing at REGI.
Well, Raptor Education Group is a wildlife rehabilitation and education facility, and we take care of any native avian species that is injured or sick, orphaned, and get them back out into the wild. We also do an awful lot of education as well.
Mm-hmm. And how many raptors right now do you have at this point?
We have about 350 patients right now. And
really?
On an annual basis, we do over 100 eagles per year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the rest are of various species, from swans through robins and smaller species.
And what is the makeup of your staff?
We have four.
Four.
We have a staff.
Four to 300.
We are
okay.
We are a nonprofit. We have four, and unfortunately, we don't have a lot of volunteers. It would be beneficial if we had more, but we are in a remote area in Antigo, located in Antigo, Wisconsin, and it's not convenient for a lot of volunteers.
800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to ask a question of either our guests about either the Birds and Art exhibition, artwork, and the science behind crows and ravens and their unique intelligence. There is a connection between wildlife art and the effort to protect wildlife and the natural world that sustains it. It's evident every year at the Birds and Art exhibit. Here are some comments we recorded at last year's exhibit with avian artists Guy Koliak, Andrea Rich, and, of course, Karen Bondarchuk. The interviews were conducted by Glenn Moberg, and it's a piece that was produced by Mackenzie Martin.
You know, Wausau, the Woodson Museum, it's an amazing museum. It's a beautiful museum. Wausau is a beautiful town.
It's one of the pinnacles of bird art in the world. It really captures the breadth of avian art. They're really looking at bird art from every aspect.
One reason they have it is they treat the artists with respect. No art show in the country has ever treated artists the way these people do.
It draws people from all over the world. They do something here that you really don't see anywhere else. The museum gathers all the artists together. We spend a weekend together. It's like a family reunion almost every year. It's a real highlight of my year.
There isn't an artist alive that doesn't die to get into this show.
What do you find inspiring? What inspires you to paint?
When you grow up in the concrete jungles of New York, and you get down to the barrier beaches of Long Island, or you get into the woods in the West, it's going into the local woods that made me want to go to the Rockies and to Alaska and to Africa. It's like a cathedral. It really is.
I was always interested in wildlife. I thought I would be doing more mammals, but as time goes on, you know, once you've done a buffalo, you know, it's a big square block kind of every way you look at it, whereas the birds are very colorful and they're always, every posture is different, and every time you look at them, they're in a different pose. You can move them around the composition. So they've really grown on me over the years.
It was John Marsliff who talked about this idea of coevolution that happens with these birds and us. And I see their behavior as being really close to our behavior. They're intelligent, they're annoying, they're gregarious, they have all of the qualities that humans have in a slightly different package. So,
tell me about the piece that's on exhibit today.
Well, it's a raven, and it's called Tempest, and it's a large, kind of moody charcoal, mainly inspired by the horrific winters we've been having in Michigan.
My piece in this exhibition is a long-eared owl. And there's a couple of fledglings in a tree, and I saw them at the Mercy Hot Springs out in California.
Curiously enough, that's a barrier beach on Long Island, and I used to go down there birding and walking in the wintertime. You're down there all by yourself, and you see the ocean and the birds.
You see a connection between your artwork and environmental preservation.
Absolutely. I mean, if we keep spreading out and exchanging rivers and forests for concrete and glass, the animals in the rivers and forests aren't going to live in concrete and glass. So that what's happening is the population is encroaching more and more, both in Africa and right here in the States.
And crows and ravens are really interesting because they are scavengers, they're opportunistic, and so they're able to adapt to pretty much anything that's going on. And I see us doing pretty much the same right now with, you know, climate change going on. Humans are, you know, we're scrambling, trying to adapt to what's going on around us.
So if you like wildlife, if you like the outdoors, if you like nature, it's imperative that we try to preserve it.
Conversations held last year at last year's Birds and Art exhibit at the Woodson Art Museum with avian artists Guy Koliak, Andrea Rich, and Karen Bondarchuk. Produced by Mackenzie Martin, the song Yellowbird was performed by Chet Atkins. The Woodson Art Museum, Karen, will be featuring a very personal piece of yours called Ergo Sum, A Crow a Day, and it's a project that was inspired by your mother's experience with Alzheimer's disease. Why did you choose crows for this piece?
You know, I was thinking about the idea of the ordinary, the common, and so that was really what sort of brought on the crow. But the work actually grew out of a drawing that I had done of an imprinted owl that I met at another rehabilitation center, ironically, in Wakanda, Illinois, called Barn Swallow.
And Linda Brewer, the director of Barn Swallow, has this lovely little screech owl named Hubert who came into her several years ago. He's an imprinted bird, so he can't be released into the wild because he can't fend for himself. And I'd done this drawing of Hubert in which I had drawn him with a mouse a day. And that piece is actually at the Woodson and can be viewed there for the next few months. And so I started thinking about Hubert being fed a mouse a day. And my mother is now in a full-time care facility, long-term care. And she's fed three meals a day because she's unable to care for herself. And I couldn't help but draw parallels between those two. And so that's kind of where the series came from. But the crow for me really represents that idea of something that we take for granted, something that's always there. It's ubiquitous. They're pretty much everywhere. And I liked that idea of it just being the everyday thing. Like we often take for granted, you know, the people around us who we care about. They're in our lives every day until they're not. And so for me, it represented that. The series kind of took on a life of its own at a certain point and expanded a little bit with some ravens being in there. My mother lives in British Columbia. Ravens are a common sight there, so I decided, okay, I can add ravens in too. But that was sort of the genesis of the crow being there.
Did your mother have a reaction to that?
My mom is really no longer able to comprehend, mm-hmm. And so she's in the later stages of Alzheimer's at this point. I did visit her a couple of times during the year that I created that series and sat with her and did some drawings, which for me was a nice way to connect to what it was I was doing. It kind of reinforced that idea of, you know, I'm here with you now and I'm, you know, able to connect with you in this way.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Today on Route 51, we're talking about the secret life and the intelligence of crows and ravens and the intersection of art and science as we preview this year's Birds and Art exhibit with Kathy Kelsey Foley of the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, master wildlife artist Karen Bondarchuk, and Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group. I'm Rick Ryer. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742 or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page and we'll read it live on the air. We're going to take a short break, but first, here's Vincent Price.
Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting still, is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Security Healthcare and Z Bella Boutique play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to be free.
Paul McCartney and the Beatles, as we talk about the intelligence of blackbirds and other birds on Route 51 and this year's Birds and Art exhibit at the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau. Our guests today, Museum Director Kathy Kelsey Foley, Master Wildlife Artist Karen Bondarchuk, and Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group. I'm Rick Ryer. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Marge Gibson, the name Reggie stands for Raptor Education Group Incorporated. Most people know you as a wildlife rehabilitation center, but education, as we talked about briefly before, is a core part of your mission. What kind of outreach and learning activities do you take part in, or do you sponsor or develop?
We do an awful lot of programs, adult and children's programs, but we do about 280 a year, actually. During the summer, we have tours at our facility. People can see things up close and personal, and they can do photos should they wish to. A lot of artists actually come, so they can have representations that are correct or the feather colors, that sort of thing. We also have a summer camp for children, which has been very exciting and very popular as well. So I think we do kind of a combination of things, a lot of natural history information, as well as intelligence and leading into how conservation is so important for the world around us, and the avian species is a huge part of that.
Now, a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to come to your place, fascinating place, and you had just taken in an adult bald eagle. I believe it had lead poisoning. And it was still very agitated and going through some sort of a mood thing. I wasn't quite sure, and I couldn't remember what you told me at the time.
I think there were convulsions and
yeah,
things.
There yeah, there was. Yeah. And you said, you had me put my hand on its chest, and the instant I did that, it calmed down. It was an incredible experience, and something I've never, ever had the opportunity to do, and I probably will never again. And here we are at your place at the Reggie Rehab Center, and the three of us with this one eagle was just an incredible thing. How do you, in the wild, when you come across a bird in distress, how do you get to the point where you are able to bring it in to safety, into a cage, a box, if you will, and bring it back to your center? How does that happen?
You know, adaptability is a sign of intelligence, so let's just first say that. And the fact that they adapt to the idea that they're not well or that they're injured and really need help is the first step. They judge, as predators, especially eagles and the other predators, and crows and ravens as well, even the omnivores, evaluate their environment constantly, and they have to. It's a means of survival. And when I do programs for children, I always say everything in nature makes sense. And in this case, it makes sense as well. They're not able to care for themselves. They fully realize that they're injured. They're not able to fly or whatever. And they need help, frankly. So basically, using a gentle voice and approaching them, they know from across the field, you know, whether you're going to injure them or not. And their evaluations are much more accurate than I think ours are as humans. Perhaps one time we had that instinct, but we have lost a lot of that natural instinct. But theirs is intact and well. And going up to them and, you know, just being very soft-spoken and gentle with them, mm-hmm. they respond in kind.
Now, most people, and myself included, had not heard of you or Reggie until the Exxon Valdez situation. Tell us what that was like, and tell us what you did as part of that operation.
I was a captain of the Eagle Capture and Health Assessment Program during the Exxon Valdez, and for the most part, I was out on boats looking for eagles that were injured or that were oiled to recover them. And we didn't do the actual washing on the boat, but I did blood testing and then transporting them to a facility that could rehabilitate them. That was an amazing experience for us. I thought it would be just the horror of the, of the oil. But in fact, we learned so much about behavior of the birds. and how they actually shared hunting territories, which they don't naturally do, particularly during breeding season, which it was. And they shared with each other the open spaces that weren't oiled. So it was really a very interesting time for us there.
And one of the unique things that you have at the center right now is something you built, was the eagle enclosure. Tell us about that.
Well, we have a large eagle flight. Birds that come in that are injured, broken wings or broken legs, one very important aspect of it is they have to recover fully. They have to be fully conditioned before they go back out into the wild. You can't. They can't, for instance, just fly across a room and then be released. Just like us, they need to develop their muscles so they can be very accurate when they're fishing or when they're catching their prey. So it's a large conditioning flight, and they exercise in there. And when it's the last place that they go before they're released to the wild.
We have a caller on the line, and I'd like to talk with Keith. Thank you so much, Keith, for calling.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hey, I got three things. First, compliments on those giant cranes that you have just outside the building. What are they, 2-3 stories tall out of saplings and so forth?
Yeah,
those are really neat.
Keith, thank you so much. It's called The Dance, and it was created by two Boston artists who call themselves the Myth Makers, Donna Dodson and Andy Morlean. And the saplings are all local. Donna and Andy were here in June to create that piece. It's about 29 feet tall. And it is exciting. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that game that was mentioned earlier about which object or painting would you like to take home? That's a game that my wife and I created for ourselves, stumbled upon for ourselves, and really enjoy. And occasionally
you.
We enjoy engaging others in the exhibition to participate in it, too. It causes you to go back and look at things again more than just, you know, passing through once. And so we really enjoy that game.
Oh, excellent. And I think that you don't always, if you came back to an exhibition, let's say during the 11 weeks of Birds and Art, depending on your mood, you might like something very different on Tuesday than you did on Sunday or on Saturday. So I hope you'll visit the Woodson Art Museum this fall and see Birds and Art. And
every year.
Good. If I'm there, ask for me, and I would love to play the game with you.
Oh, that would be fun.
I would love that.
And then you were talking about crows and ravens, and up in this part of the country, we don't see too many ravens, but when you go to American Southwest, there's a lot more ravens there. And the most noticeable thing about them to me was how loud their flying is. You can hear the wind through their feathers and their wings. From a surprising distance, a whoosh, whoosh, whoosh as they're not gliders, they're flappers. And that was the first thing we noticed about them. Of course, it helped that we were in a canyon area when the ravens were flying up there. The sound, of course, was concentrated by the stone walls, but we've noticed it elsewhere in the open and so forth. And anyhow, that's just kind of a neat thing about ravens.
Thank you for your call, Larry. Keith, have enjoy the museum and enjoy the exhibit coming up starting this weekend.
You bet. Thanks.
Karen Bedarczyk, you've been influenced by the work of Japanese artist Hasui Kawase. Is that pronounced correctly?
Yes, Hasui Kawase.
And his ability to capture the atmospheric mood and his art of the early 20th century Japan of watercolors in everyday life seems to be more popular here than it is in Japan. And tell us a little bit about that influence and your reflection on his work and the popularity of his work.
Hasui Kawase is the work that I'm most drawn to of his is his woodblock prints. And he, more than anyone, is able to create a mood and an atmosphere with a woodblock, which is an incredible thing to be able to do. I mean, if you've looked at Andrea Rich's work, for instance, or Sherry York's work, I mean, these are people who understand the difficulty of creating mood with something that's cut into wood and then printed. And Kawase, for me, it's about mood, but it's also about understanding composition in a fundamental way, that everything in his pictures feels like it's supposed to be there. There's an entering in that you do that is seamless. And, you know, as an educator, I'm always looking for good examples to talk to my students about. You know, look at the composition. Why is it good? Why does this one work? You know, how does it work? And so for me, Kawase has become an important part of my own inspiration, but also in teaching.
How do you, as a teacher, help your students find that inspiration?
Oh, I do it in different ways. You know, I use a lot of visuals, certainly PowerPoint presentations of artists' works. And what I will often do is I'll put up two works side by side and say, let's talk about the compositions in these works. One could be a Sui Kawase woodblock print. The other could be a painting by Holbein. And we'll talk about how they're different. You know, one might be an asymmetrical composition, which, of course, in the case of Hasui Kawase in the Japanese tradition, asymmetry really was coming out of Japan. And, you know, of course, once Japan was opened in 1850 to the world, it exploded. Impressionism was influenced. Cubism was influenced. Everybody was influenced by Japan and this beautiful asymmetry. So we'll talk about, you know, how does asymmetry work in a picture? How does symmetry work in a picture? How does it make you feel different? You know, when you look at a symmetrical picture, there's a centeredness. There's a kind of calming feeling. Asymmetry is more dynamic. So, you know, it's a way to kind of educate the students about how do you make the viewer understand what you're trying to say, and how does composition work into that? How does color work into that? Overlapping of imagery, large images versus small images. So, you know, it runs the gamut. The PowerPoints will happen. I teach, you know, this semester I'm actually teaching an object drawing class, which is primarily perceptual and observational drawing. So the students have to learn how to draw what's in front of them, the translation of multidimensional to the two-dimensional surface, which is not easy.
So. And Kathy, taking from what Karen just said, how do you translate that or transition that to the museum experience, especially with the Birds and Art?
So excellent question, Rick. And I wonder sometimes how artists feel about curators and Andy McGivern and Jane Weinke, who do a fabulous, I think, job of installing exhibitions, specifically Birds and Art, because the way in which artworks are presented in galleries absolutely impacts the experience that visitors have, whether it's lines of sight, whether it's pairings, the way the compare and contrast, and they're both equally powerful. And looking at symmetry, looking at asymmetry, works that are compatible, works that have a tension, those are subtle but conscious elements utilized by museum curators and preparators and installers. Lighting, labeling, wall color. We chatted this morning with Karen and Andy about the color, the accent color used in the Master Artist Gallery. All of those things impact the response that visitors have.
Today on Route 51, we're talking about the intelligence of crows and ravens and the intersection of art and science as we preview this year's Birds and Art exhibit with Kathy Kelsey Foley of the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, master wildlife artist Karen Bondarchuk, and March Gibson of the Raptor Education Group. I'm Rick Ryer in for Glenn Moberg this week. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. or you can certainly comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and we'll be sure to read that on the air. And as we're heading into this break, there's a little bit of a Raven song from Dan Fogelberg.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like the Girl Scouts of the Northwestern Great Lakes and Marshfield Clinic play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
The white bird dreams of the aspen tree with the dying leaves turning gold. But the white bird just sits in the cage growing old. It's
a beautiful day with her classic song from the 60s, White Bird. I understand that's one of Kathy's favorite songs. On Route 51, as we talk about this year's Birds and Art exhibit at Wausau's Woods and Art Museum and the connection between wildlife and science, our guest today, Museum Director Kathy Kelsey Foley, Master Wildlife Artist Karen Bondarchuk, and Marge Gibson of the Raptor Education Group. Kathy Kelsey Foley, I do have a question regarding how do you come up with the master wildlife artist? How does that work?
Oh my gosh, Rick, that's the secret sauce.
I want to know.
You want to know? Well, there are probably, I think with this year's exhibition, we've now over 41 years shown the work of 1,011 artists, and we have honored 35 masters. So not really being a mathematical wizard, but subtracting quickly 1,000, subtracting 35 from 1,011, it's safe to say that the balance all want to know the answer to that question too. It is a combination of feedback from other master artists, from museum staff, and it's really now a staff decision that is endorsed by the museum's board. There's no clear path to the limelight. It's a almost imperceptible kind of a je ne sais quoi that. I'm really being cagey here, aren't I? but suffice to say that honoring Karen, that decision was one that was arrived at with great enthusiasm by our staff, by our board, and by other master artists, and I would say that a crow a day was a major tipping element because we wanted to be able to show those 365 works in their entirety. And that has that space, and again, that is unusual for Birds and Art as well, and that Karen's Master Artist exhibition occupies multiple spaces at the museum, which is exciting. We're always changing it up. There is a contemplative feel in the gallery that is home to 365 crows and also one of Karen's tire-scavenged crows. That contemplative feeling is, for me, not unlike the experience I had in Houston at the Rothko Chapel. And that's a mighty very, heavy praise there, Ms. Karen.
That's a very high compliment, Kathy. Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to press you on that question any longer, but I just always have been curious about that. Let's go to the phones now. Larry in Wisconsin Rapids been holding for a while. Thanks, Larry.
Hello. I'm out in the garden, weeding the garden, and I have 11 grandchildren. And my question is mostly for Marge. We brought him up there each whenever we can get up there, and it's been four or five times. We enjoy the interns from the university that are working there. I have one nine-year-old who knows all the questions because she's been there four times, and I'm wanting her to see Marge in action sometime. And I'm wondering just how I would, she lives in Minnesota about 4 hours away, so I'm wondering how we can get that accomplished.
Well, maybe we can start with doing some email so we can arrange a time when she's going to be local, and we can maybe set something up. It's really important to reach children when they're interested, and at her age, I was certainly starting to do wildlife rehabilitation, believe it or not, when I was eight. So with my parents' help and blessing, and that's been a very long time ago, but it's so important to honor children's preferences when they're little. Once they reach 16, 17, other things take preference, and often they forget about those passions that they had when they were young. So let's start communicating.
Okay, should I send you an email? And,
let's do it.
Go from there?
Let's do it.
Keep up the good work, everybody.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you. Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to go to Dave in Wausau. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm outside here. I'm going to get out of the wind. A little windy. First of all, I want to say what a great arts community we have here in Wausau. My daughter graduated with the help of went and got a scholarship with the help of a Carolyn March scholarship. And so big fan of everything you guys are doing. Also, I'm one of a multitude of social media stalkers of Reggie and Marge.
Thank
and,
you.
I want to just this talk about intelligence, relative intelligence, and some birds being way smarter than some people we know. A study came. I heard news of a study last week where they were reassessing the conventional idea that size of brain determines intelligence, and they're looking at blood flow as a more important factor. And I'm at work. I'm going to let you guys chew on that. It's just riveting to me to contemplate that. So I'd like to hear Marge ponder that a little. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
I think there's so many things that that affect intelligence, and it's excellent that people are beginning to visit new ideas and to give credit to the fact that you don't have to have a massive brain to be an intelligent individual. In fact, I think some of the largest brains in humans are people who were perhaps not intelligent at all. But it's amazing that that they use a lot of intelligence to get them through the natural history of their life, but they also adapt to ours, which is actually better than we can do. We don't adapt to their world very well.
Karen Benarczyk, as people come to see your work, what do you hope they come away with?
Oh, you know, some of the most gratifying conversations I've had over the years with people who have seen my work have been the ones in which someone will say, I never really thought about crows and ravens as being intelligent. I never thought about them as having consciousness. And that for me is really heartening when someone can say, you've changed the way I see something. I feel like I've done my good deed for the day when that happens. So, you know, that and hopefully a greater respect for just understanding that these creatures have consciousness. This idea of intelligence is not necessarily how we quantify intelligence. They have their own set of, you know, criteria that they gauge their own intelligence by, and we may not understand that because we're not them. So, yeah, just understanding that they're worthy of their place on the planet. So.
And Kathy Kelsey Foley, your last word about what's coming up this weekend and how long the Birds and Art will be here in Wausau.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Well, it's Birds and Art 41, opening on Saturday, September 10th, and 11 weeks of the best indoor bird watching on the planet. That's my claim, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. We're all looking forward to it. We want to thank today's guests. Kathy Kelsey Foley, director of the always free Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum. You can find out more about the museum and this year's Birds and Art exhibit at lywam.org. Thanks also to this year's master wildlife artist, Karen Bondarchuk, and to March Gibson, executive director at the Raptor Education Group. You can find out more about the center and its work at raptoreducationgroup.org. I'm Rick Ryer of Wisconsin Public Radio and our on-air producer, Jana Rose Schleiss. Thanks to Glenn Moberg for his assistance in producing this program. Thanks also to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme and special music today from Aaron Embry, Chad Atkins, Marty Stewart, Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe, Paul McCartney, Dan Fogelberg, It's a Beautiful Day, and Inez and Charlie Fox. And until next week, we're heading out of town.